Bill and I went over to the Henry Ford Museum and looked at the old cars there, looking at the wheels only, of course. And the only element that we could come up with was the hexagonal or octagonal, mostly hexagonal, nut. Large one that we found on quite a number of the cars, Packards, some Rolls Royces.
Packard had a, yeah, that was one of their trademarks.
That was one of their trademarks.
Yeah.
So we picked up that element, and the new wheel cover that we designed for the Mark, and which Bunky enthusiastically approved, and had this element on it. And I've noted that ever since that, it has proliferated the whole industry. Practically everybody has, most people with wire wheel covers have that element in them now. Well, we introduced the sunroof and eventually the moonroof in the Mark series.
Hey, background on that, what inspiration did you have for that?
Well, the moonroof, of course, was not an invention on our part. That was Heinz Prechter's thing, but the idea of...
He runs what company?
American Sunroof. Well, right. It's gotten to be a real combine now.
Mm-hmm. Started out in Troy, was it, or where was it?
I think it's in Southfield.
Southfield, right.
Yeah.
Prechter.
Southgate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Prechter, German guy.
Yeah, right.
Real nice guy. I know him well.
Mm-hmm. You think it's in Southgate rather than Southfield?
Yeah, Southgate.
Okay.
Anyway, recalling the earlier cars I'd been involved with, the 55 Ford with a tinted transparent roof, and the more recent development of being able to mirrorize glass. So that it's reflective and yet still transparent. Yeah. I guess with Kopkin, I worked on this. And working with Heinz Prechter, we developed the so-called moonroof, which is Prechter's sliding roof, but a mirrorized glass panel instead.
Mm-hmm. Did he copyright any of these names? Moonroof, for instance?
I think that was concocted by the advertising agency of the Lincoln Mercury Division.
Okay. That would be Kenyon and Eckhart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They, of course, Lincoln Mercury Division, were by now in love with the car.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Their bread and butter.
Yeah, it was really knocking the pins out of Eldorado to them.
Mm-hmm. It was a little stodgy at this time, as I recall.
Actually, the first Eldorado, I thought, was one of the very best ones.
Yeah, but they had gooped it up, didn't they?
Well, they started to, you know, like a lot of things, it got progressively worse.
Yeah.
But the first one...
Your style remained fairly clean.
It is, until the Mark VI is a terrible mark. I mean, that again harked back to the marks of the late 50s and 60s. It was merely a gooped up... Lincoln,
right. Yeah.
The Mark VI was.
Mm-hmm. A lineal descendant of the first Mark V.
Yeah, right. You might say so. I did quite a number of special marks for Bourdonnais, and I'll show you photographs of them a little later.
Special in what sense?
Oh, custom paint, custom interiors. One of them was real spooky. It was... I called it Black Diamond. It was a metallic black finish, which looked like black diamond dust or anthracite coal dust, you might say. And a new technique, which the some plating company was trying to interest me in, was utilized black chrome. Now, it's hard to describe black chrome because it's shiny. Yet it doesn't look like shiny black paint. It looks like you can imagine a film of black put over chrome, a transparent black film put over chrome. It was pretty spooky looking.
Fascinating.
This car was really spooky looking.
Who tried to interest you in this?
Oh, some plating company.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, okay, I'll give it a try. We'll put it on some... I told Gene I was going to do this first because it's his car.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he thought it would be, you know, pretty great.
Mm-hmm.
But... And I had these people do it, and they started running into all kinds of problems of not being able to keep it consistent and so forth. And because originally they were trying to talk, interest me into it from an industrial standpoint, you know.
Yeah.
It's a production feasible thing. Yeah.
Was it a U.S. company or a foreign company?
Yeah, it was U.S. I don't recall who it was.
Okay.
But they eventually did furnish the parts after many tries, but stuff was never used to my knowledge because they couldn't work out a quality, consistent process.
Yeah. Well, now, as you well know, recently chrome has gone out of fashion.
Well, and it has to some extent.
To some extent.
Yeah.
Some of the more avant-garde cars from Europe, I believe, are now using bright work without the bright.
Well, there are U.S. cars that are forged now, too. For instance,
yeah.
I've seen a Thunderbird turbo coupe.
That's right.
Where the front end grille, which is normally chrome, mm-hmm. is painted body color.
Right.
Mustang similar.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a Cougar with a painted grille. Right, you got it. It's a style swing that's will go eventually.
Telnek told the story that happened by accident when he was in Ford of Europe. That on one of their surveys, they accidentally painted over the chrome, and everybody liked it. And so they said, "Well, what the hell? Why don't we do it then?" So.
Well, it's different when you're in the business of establishing and maintaining style trends, whether it's automobiles, whether it's clothing, whether it's music, popular music, whatever it is. The one thing you can't do is stand still.
Yeah.
You cannot be successful by doing the same thing over and over again. You have to change. Whether in the eye of the beholder it's a change for the better, that remains to be seen, but
yeah.
Change you have to do.
Yeah.
And I realize that now too, because I've been very critical of recent cars, but I realize that I'm basing that on what I did, you know, years ago, and that if I were still doing that now, I was very shortly stopped doing that because nobody would look at it. You have to continually come up with new ideas,
right.
Refreshing things. Things run in cycles, however, and you won't forever see this blackout look.
Yeah.
It's faddish, you know,
yeah.
And it's different looking.
Trendy.
And it tends to look slightly ominous, you know, gives
yeah.
cars a kind of a mean look in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so much for that. There have been a number of marks that have followed, and most of them have been good or excellent. I think one of the finest was the Mark V, which I had nothing to do with, but which I think is a great looking car.
Had you moved on to another responsibility?
Yes, I spent, I guess, about the last, most, probably about 10 years of my career at Ford in interior design.
Uh-huh. Did you enjoy this?
Yes, I've always liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Although at the end, or a couple of years before I retired, I asked to be transferred out of it because I thought I'd like to have a different assignment, but that was not to be.
Who were you under at that time?
Bourdonnais.
Still Bourdonnais, of course.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Probably directed to him on that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Was it the Lincoln Mercury interiors or the Ford interiors?
All of them.
All of them, so you had the interior studio.
The interior design office.
Right.
All automotive and truck interiors.
Oh, great.
They even did a tractor cab.
Which was just becoming popular.
Yes, enclosed cabs for tractors. We did one of those.
Right.
It was a very fussy project. It had so many functional requirements on it.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting.
Okay.
Right. One of the more interesting aspects of this was the designer series marks.
Oh, yes.
Which got me involved with three designers and one executive of Cartier is not a design firm as such. So I worked with their general manager, I guess was his name, Ralph Destino.
Got nice, how you spell that?
Destino. On the Cartier versions. Now, most people probably think that that these people actually designed the marks that bear their names, such is not the case.
Can you elaborate on that? That's kind of an interesting
episode. Yeah, I'm about to elaborate.
Yeah.
First of all, you have in a large car company, you have what's called complexity. Complexity is number of parts times number of colors. That's loosely it. And it runs into, I guess, millions of items. Every time you make a blue interior, for instance, you've got blue fabric, blue carpet, blue plastic parts, blue this, blue that, blue that, headlining, knobs, all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Every time you add an interior or an exterior paint, mm-hmm. you multiply complexity by parts, and it's something that has to be controlled. Otherwise, you'll drown in complexity.
Mm-hmm.
The more expensive a car is, the more complexity it has, probably, because you offer a wider range of colors, exterior and interior, to the customer.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what he pays for, a big choice. But complexity is something that has to be controlled, even in the top luxury cars. So you cannot let these designers muck around with special exterior and interior colors. We don't let them do that at all anyway. What we do is we put existing exterior and interior colors together in ways that they haven't been done before, and then add some special touches,
mm-hmm.
striping or this, that, and the other thing,
mm-hmm.
a few touches. Now, it was difficult at the outset to get these guys to acknowledge or to understand this. I had a kind of lecture to them.
Mm-hmm.
We did have three actual designers, Bill Blass, Emilio Pucci, and Hubert de Givenchy.
Who picked these designers,
As far as I know, the Lincoln Mercury division and its advertising agency did. We had nothing to do with it.
Blass, B-L-A-S-S.
Yeah, Bill Blass, American designer.
Pucci, P-U-C-C-I.
And
Givenchy,
G-I-V-E-N-C-H-E-Y, I believe.
Correct.
Hubert de Givenchy.
What was his first name?
Hubert, H-U-B-E-R-T.
Hubert, I never knew that.
Hubert de Givenchy.
De Givenchy, okay.
Bill Blass, never any problem with him at all.
Nice guy.
He's an American guy, real nice guy, full of beans and everything, and he liked everything we did. Thought it was just great.
Did they come out to Dearborn to talk to you?
Yeah.
Or did you go to New York?
Well, the Lincoln Mercury Division usually brought these people in for about a week, all of them at one time, to review what we had cooked up for them.
I see, okay.
And the guy, usually we had no problem. Givenchy, it was a little difficult at first to get him to understand this complexity situation.
Mm-hmm.
Pucci never did.
Language problem?
No language problem. He just didn't understand why we couldn't, do what he wanted us to do with, combinations of purple and blues and rose and this, that, and the other thing. I said, we can't do that. We have to work with what we got.
That's fairly simple.
A real super guy, on the other hand. He's a
county,
so he's nobility.
Pucci?
I'll get to that a little later.
Okay.
So I think we introduced these designer series first on the Mark IV. In fact, I know we did. With the first four of them. Highly successful. Made lots of money. We didn't have much investment in them at all, really, because we worked with what we had. We just put things together a different way. For instance, on the first Bill Blass car, the lower body was blue, medium metallic blue, and the upper, the top was covered with a cream-colored vinyl, which existed to go with an exterior cream.
Mm-hmm.
Body color that was also in the line, but was never put together with blue. So those are the kind of tricks we did. See, we did unusual combinations.
Were you your own color man, or did you have a couple of talented people on staff?
The interior design office was by far the biggest one in the Ford design
uh-huh.
building, because it encompassed not only the design activity, but it had an experimental trim shop and the trim and color section upstairs. And we were spread all over the building. Yeah, the trim and color activity reported to the interior design office. I had some talented people up there that would work on this, you know, including some girls, putting together these things that we would review and decide, yeah, there, this is what we want to do before we even brought anybody in.
This is where the ladies usually broke in at this period, did they not?
Yes.
Yes. Fabrics and colors?
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, we had some in design, and now they got some doing clay modeling too.
Right.
Yeah, some are very good. Yeah. There was a lot of resistance at first, you know, oh, girls can't design cars, and the colors will be terrible, or it'll be fruity looking or something like that. Worked out fine.
Dumb resistance.
Then it got to, sometimes we were faced with a deadline. For one reason or another, we hadn't gotten decisions out of these people, or agreements really is what there was, and I had to do some traveling.
The designers, you'd speak.
Yeah, we never had any problem at all with Ralph Destino from Cartier. He was always in agreement with what we did. But I had to go to New York a couple of times, meet with Bill Blass. That was a lot of fun too, because he'd put on a fashion show for me.
Oh.
Really exciting. I mean, beautiful bottles and gowns and everything. And I'd take the stuff to him. I'd take what we called swatch boards.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be usually a side view rendering of the car, showing the colors, color chips with paint and vinyl and the interior material swatches and all that sort of stuff.
And you have a plastic overlay and you can,
yeah,
you can switch them back.
Yeah, in a nice little folder and all that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I had to do the same. I had to go to Europe once and do the same with Givenchy and Pucci.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to Paris to meet with Givenchy, he was utterly charming. He took me to lunch with the French movie star named Capucine.
Oh, yes.
Who I recall seeing in a Peter Sellers movie or something.
James Bond movie.
Of James Bond movie?
I think one of the
I don't know.
It was a spoof on James.
A spoof, yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous woman.
Mm-hmm.
We went to a very fine French restaurant for lunch and just had a marvelous time eating and drinking and talking.
Oh wait, was it the first Pink Panther film?
I don't know what it was.
Was she his wife in that? Yeah.
Yeah, marvelous.
Yeah.
And he went along with what I'd brought over. Then I went from there to Florence to meet with Emilio Pucci. You ought to see what he's got there. He stems from a line of royalty that goes back to the Renaissance.
Yeah.
And his place of abode and work is in the Palazzo Pucci, which is in the center of Florence. It's a fortress.
Okay.
Dates back to the Renaissance. He took me to lunch in his own private dining room in the fortress with his daughter, who was on recess from school. Mm-hmm. An absolutely elegant lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Pointed out a painting on the wall that was done by Verrocchio. Or was it? It was one of the great Renaissance Italian painters. It was a wedding feast.
Mm-hmm.
And he pointed out his relatives. Verrocchio, I think it was.
How do you spell that?
V-E-R, I don't know, there's a couple of C's in it. Verrocchio?
C-H-I-O.
Yeah, it was a great painting.
Uh-huh.
And again, I had a bit of a problem with him, but finally sort of, well, We were great friends. He said, well, Dave, he says, if that's what you think it should be, let it be, you know, that sort of thing. Sort of a resigned. I think I said
that worked out pretty well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that one was so late that I had to send a wire back to Dearborn to let them know that
release
it was okay
certain.
To go ahead and release it.
Now, where would it go from there, technically?
wherever it go from there?
Yeah.
Well, it goes out on what's called an FAB chart.
What does that stand for?
Well, I wish I knew. it's one that's so old, it's a designation so old that it's, I guess no one really knows what it stands for. Mm-hmm. It's like an SBB drawing, which I'll tell you about a little later. Mm-hmm.
FAV.
That is a chart which is cross-referenced, and it's issued on every name of car, every series, every model, 2 and 4 door. A lot of them go out.
Uh-huh.
Of course, on a Mark 3 or any Mark series, it's usually only one chart, because except the second chart goes out for the designer series. There's one chart for the basic mm-hmm. production car and the second one for the designer series. And the title block will tell you what it is, you know, 1971 Mark so-and-so designer series
mm-hmm.
release.
Yeah.
This is released from the design office.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes from there into body engineering, and goes to the trim plant in Mount Clemens, or wherever it is now, and the paint people and so mm-hmm. forth. And it goes to the Lincoln Mercury Division. It goes to anyone who has need for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the official release. That's the go-ahead to, you know, start doing this,
uh-huh. maybe
put it together.
Uh-huh.
An SBB drawing is, I don't think they call them that anymore, but that used to be the official full-size body draft of a new model that went left styling, as it was called then, and went into body engineering.
Uh-huh.
It was done by a drafting group right in styling.
Mm-hmm.
And SBB stood for Styling Blackboard. SBD, I guess. Styling Blackboard Drawing.
Okay, SBD.
Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Good.
But that isn't done anymore, because the contours of a model are now taken off with an electronic scanner that tracks the surface every inch or so all the way along the line.
Uh-huh.
And records the thing on a computer. And It's an entirely different system. The human hands drawing all these lines are a thing of the past.
You must tell us a bit about your feeling for that new development, as opposed to the style that you had grown up with.
Well, again, it's like everything else. Progress will have its way,
mm-hmm.
and usually for the better. A styling blackboard drawing was something I never was involved in. That was after the fact.
Yeah.
My work pretty well stopped with the approved clay model,
mm-hmm.
and when what we called the feasibility model, which was a very finely tuned separate one derived from the approved one,
mm-hmm.
very carefully done so that all the contours were precise.
Mm-hmm.
And from there on in, others took over
mm-hmm.
and recorded the surfaces originally on paper, but now through electronic means into computer readouts, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
I'm sure it's a much better system. It's certainly faster. It's even probably more accurate.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
In fact, I read in the Ford Times recently that the entire roof panel for the upcoming Ford Aerostar van was taken right off the clay feasibility model by computer, and never had to go through the body engineering process at all. Went right to the tool maker.
How
right
was that?
Right from the clay model.
Because it was felt collectively that there was no derivation needed. No.
Right. It was the model was that carefully done, and it was scanned electronically. You know, no human hands were involved to interpret anything.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right from the clay model. Well, I think that about winds up my reminiscences.
No, we're not going to let you get off that easily.
All right. Well, you want to
tell us a little bit about your. You sort of skimmed over 10 years. What were these trips to Europe and Japan you were taking?
Those were authorized trips to auto shows.
Ah.
Yeah.
And now, were these helpful, or were these boondoggles?
Little Beach.
Little Beach, okay.
I tried to make them as helpful as possible to others in the design center by carefully photographing everything.
Uh-huh.
I think I was the only one that did that.
Mm-hmm.
I would photograph every show that I went to, and when I got back, I'd give my film to our photographic department. They'd make enlargements of it, and then I'd spread them out on a great big board, blackboard, displayed in a prominent area in the design center so that anyone walking past could stop and look at them. And I'd put out an announcement to the other studio heads, you know, that this thing had been set up and that they're welcome to look at it.
Which were the best ones?
Well, the best ones, it's hard to say. The worst ones, I start there in the Earl's Court show in London.
Was this an annual?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who was it sponsored by?
I think it was an annual. Sponsored by? I don't know. Probably by the British water industry.
Sure, okay.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What
was wrong with that?
Well, it was in a terrible... Earl's Court is a terrible exhibition facility. I guess it dates back to the Victorian times, all cut up and terrible looking inside. And it, I don't know, it just didn't attract the more interesting exhibits, cars, as I recall. The Paris Auto Show was superb.
Was it?
Oh yeah, always. And it had, you know, great looking girls and models there, and Frankfurt show was very good.
Did you ever go to a Paris show that didn't have female models draped over new models?
No, no, I don't think so.
It's become a cliche.
Yeah.
But a welcome one.
Yeah. And
Frankfurt, what about Frankfurt?
Frankfurt is a great show. I think that's every other year. I don't recall how they work now. I know that some of them were on one year and off the next.
Mm-hmm.
The Geneva show was always fine. And so was the one in Torino.
Which is Turin.
Turin.
Yeah. Which is where Ghia is.
I think so.
And a couple of others.
Yeah.
Di Tommaso.
What made them, I guess, boondoggles more than anything else was the fact that I always saved some vacation time. And tacked this onto the trip and always took my wife with me.
Oh.
Well, she did some work there too, because when I was photographing, she would make notes as to what I was
fine
taking pictures of. So it wasn't always, you know, just pure fun.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, like if I was in Germany at Frankfurt, I would also drop in on the design center in Cologne.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I was in England, I would visit them too. Then the Japan show, I don't know when it started, but we didn't send anyone to it for, I forget what year it was. I was in the second contingent that went.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it was great. It's a great auto show, but it was very constricted, almost exclusively Japanese products, cars and trucks, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Awful large exhibit on a pier. Well,
wasn't that the case with most of the national auto shows, or were they international?
No, most of them were international.
Oh, okay.
And you saw a lot of experimental and show cars at
them,
which was kind of nice.
Advanced styling.
Right. But the opportunity to go to the Japan show was great, because it was a very interesting show, although, as I said, it was Japanese, but you saw so many things that they didn't export at the time that were quite interesting. And my wife and I, once we got two of that, we went on a 2-week tour of Japan.
Oh.
Kind of neat.
Mm-hmm. Back to your interior days, the last few years you were with the company, when did the thinking about occupant comfort, which I guess has been described at least this product as ergonomics,
human factors, got a number of names. I can't tell you exactly when. Actually, it was always there, you know, an interior.
In industrial design, it had popped up about a decade
ago. Yeah, a lot of things, if you, for instance, think about the word environment.
Yeah.
It was in no popular usage at all 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
I know when I first ran across it, I didn't know what it meant.
Uh-huh.
But human factors is a little less scientific word for ergonomics.
Mm-hmm.
But it had always been in some considerable practice, because anytime you develop what we call the interior package of a car,
yeah,
you're primarily designing around human beings.
Right.
Because that's what's in there.
But forgive me, didn't it seem that there was a less of a recognition of the
right.
need for leg room and head room and
not
elbow room?
No, no.
Not so?
Not in
my, in the early career
there wasn't.
Really?
No.
Okay.
No, because I remember Henry Grevy, the chief body engineer, he always wore a hat when he came over to sit in a seating butt to
uh-huh.
make sure that it didn't touch the
uh-huh.
headline. This is back in the late 40s.
Late 40s.
Gradually acquired these more technical names like ergonomics and human factors, and we
human engineering
package design engineers developed for what we called OSCAR.
Oh, really?
How that name came about, I don't know, but it was an idealized median human average figure,
mm-hmm.
Size, weight, length of arms, fingers, the whole thing, and it was developed in two ways: as a three-dimensional articulated sculpture, and then as a two-dimensional plastic articulated template, you might say, that you could put on a flat drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And the eye ellipse was developed, which is the sphere that the vision that the eye takes in a horizontal and vertical plane.
Mm-hmm.
So instruments and things got placed more carefully.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to see that this has been to a large extent ignored in the new Mark 7, one of which I now have.
Oh, you do?
Which I think is a terrible car in the ergonomic respects, along with some others. It's a beautiful car to drive, you know, as a car it's superb, but there's an awful lot of wrong with it.
Isn't that odd? Because the car.
I wrote Kafka a 3-page critique on the car, and I haven't heard from
him. You haven't heard from him?
No. Of all that's wrong with
it. Who's the current interior guy? Is that Trevor Creed?
Trevor Creed.
You probably pass it on to him.
Yeah. So
hey,
well, yeah. Awful lot wrong with it.
What have they done?
Well, there's too much black on black. If you look at the instrument panel, you'll notice that they have black buttons and black controls on a black background. You can't readily see them. Now, you should say, well, you don't have to see them, just pick them out. That car has got so many controls on it, it's junky.
Uh-huh.
It's garbage. It's over-controlled. It's got stuff that I'll never use, I know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing, and it's arranged in a confusing manner.
Uh-huh.
But to change any of the heater controls, for instance, you got to pull off the side of the road and stop it so that you can. It's so far down and it's black on black. The radio controls have been super sub-miniaturized so that my wife with fingernails can't even push the memory buttons. They're only about a quarter of an inch square and they're black on black, of course. Now, I mean, it's a real tragedy. I can't imagine how it ever happened. But that's what you're talking about when you're talking ergonomics, human factors.
Yeah.
You have to take into consideration the placement of things, hopefully the color contrast of element with background and line of sight and so forth. The Continental seems to have ignored almost every one of those, because some of the primary things are so low that you know, if you deflect your eyes long enough to really take a look at it, you're off the road, yeah. Danger. But it is what it is, and it's turning. If you ever drive one of these things sometime, observe the turn indicator arrows, the
uh-huh.
little green ones.
Uh-huh.
They're about this far apart.
Mm-hmm.
They should be this far apart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's you.
Sure.
And they're so dim that they're almost invisible.
Okay.
Now, there's no excuse for either one of those.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started driving this car, I started observing these things one at a time, and I was just appalled.
Mm-hmm.
That the finest automotive expression of the Ford Motor Company was so bad. in regard to some of these things, isn't it? Really cheap, sleazy, fake wood grain stuff. It looks like it was stamped. It's a very disappointing car.
Fake wood grain?
Oh, yes.
The Mark 7?
Just terrible. And it's the fakest fake I've ever seen. Mm. Looks like a stamped tin.
Not even applique.
Well,
stamped?
No. You know, the original Mark 3 had genuine wood in it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, real wood. It was called Packa wood. It was impregnated with resin so that it was stable in, you know, the kind of conditions you get in a car of heat,
right,
humidity, and
yeah,
cold, and so forth. It wasn't
yeah,
just wood right off a log. It had been impregnated with resin so that it was, you know, stabilized.
Yeah.
But it was real wood.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, times change.
You feel a bit out of touch with some current trends.
Yes, I've adjusted my thinking about exterior design a lot. I realize that what I see is probably what I would have been doing if I were there.
Uh-huh.
So in general, I kind of like the outside, the exterior design of the Mark 7, although it isn't distinctive enough. If you look at it from the front, if you put a Thunderbird, a Mark, and a Cougar lined up and looked at their fronts from a distance, you would be hard-pressed to tell which was which. The width of the radiators of all of them must be almost exactly the same, the headlamps and everything. All the elements are identical. The car lacks distinction.
Individuality.
Yeah, it doesn't stand out. It looks, first glance, like a customized Thunderbird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, from the rear end, it gives the opinion of being too pinched looking, too narrow for its height.
Mm-hmm.
But that probably has to do with its Thunderbird underpinnings.
Apparently they were pretty much all the same mold, roughly, with extensions and refinements.
Yeah, well, the Cougar, of course, is the most distinctive in the side view because of its upper structure, which is cut off sharp.
Mm-hmm.
But the T-Bird and the Mark all have the kind of the same side profile.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the rear deck fake spare tire is distinctive and continues the heritage.
Mm-hmm.
I like driving the car. It's a really great car.
There's been some buyer resistance, I think, to the Mark 7, has there not?
Well, I gather that, and that's why I have it.
Uh-huh.
You see, I had a Ford station wagon. I always had those because they suited our lifestyle.
Uh-huh.
I only had it for 3 months. This is an 85 station wagon.
Mm-hmm.
When the lease plan announced that we could lease Mark 7s or Continentals and turn in what we had.
Uh-huh.
So my wife and I discussed it, and we decided we weren't taking any long trips or going camping, so I
mm-hmm.
have a flyer on a luxury car, so I did. And almost the day after I took delivery of it, I regretted the decision.
Mm-hmm.
I'm involved in a massive re-landscaping job where I'm going to turn three sides of the house into a Japanese garden, for which I have to haul in all kinds of stuff. I can't haul diddly in that. I mean, that I didn't realize that car was so small.
Yeah,
Mark 7. So
the town car is still fairly close to
spacious. Yeah, it's a pretty big car.
Yeah.
But as far as utilities concerned, forget it. It's a real nice car for two people,
mm-hmm.
even with its
yeah.
faults.
They've got a new model out. You probably know a new completely electronic. These are electronic as they can get these days.
The LSC.
Yeah, the LSC.
Well, it's been out for a while.
Yeah.
That was available also. I decided I didn't want that.
I asked Creed about electronic voices. He said, no, we're not going to go in that direction. He thought they were obscene.
Well, I don't think there's any place for a voice.
I don't either.
I think I'd be annoyed by it.
Yeah.
Well, doesn't seem to be the right thing.
Well, you were taking these trips to Europe as a sort of a high-level journeyman commentator?
Well, it was an authorized thing, and I guess it's still being done.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. The idea behind it was it's a little bit of a bonus in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, it gives you exposure to a big international show where you see things. Who knows? I got some ideas from some of those shows. I admit I swiped them. But what the hell, you know?
Oh, yes. All's fair.
Yeah, as Iacocca would say, probably, you know, what the hell. he didn't originate the ideas that he delivered to me by phone about the Mark III, you know. Rolls Royce and a previous Continental did that.
Speaking of that, did you notice the business about the Mini Maxi, or the Mini Max in the 70s that De La Rosa and others tried to
get started? I was very much aware of that project. I was never involved in it. I was interested in it because I thought there was a real market for the thing.
Yeah.
And it went on and on and on for years and years and years. I don't know how many models were made. De La Rosa could tell you, maybe, although I don't know whether his memory is any better than mine. But they made, I don't know how many studies of it.
Who was dragging their feet? Was that Henry Ford II, do you think?
I don't know. As I said, I was never involved in the thing, and I only looked at it, you know, from an outside, you might say. I knew it would go into the showroom, they'd have meetings on it, and drawings all over the place, you know, and competitive things, so there weren't any really competitive things. Yeah. But it went through all kinds of stages of adjustment, little changes in size and package arrangement inside and whatnot. But I don't know. I think Iacocca must have been supportive of it until he was relieved of his assignment.
Well, apparently,
whether it was his idea or not, I don't know.
Apparently he went to Chrysler because he's when he went to Chrysler, he was quoted as saying, it's easy to do once you you've already done it.
Right. He probably, he and he took an awful lot of development of that thing, you know, with him.
Yeah. And then, of course, De La Rosa came over.
Right.
And the two of them probably said, let's steal a march on everybody and put this out, yeah.
Why they did it with front drive, I'll never know, because that's a mistake, a real bad mistake in that kind of a vehicle.
Right. Apparently, Ford's new Aeroman is going to be front drive.
It's rear drive.
I beg your pardon. Yes, they're sticking with rear drive. Yes.
Yeah.
But the Voyager and the Caravan are selling like crazy.
Oh well, they've got until recently they've had no competition.
Yeah. There's now a Toyota and I think
GM is now in. They got the Chevrolet Astral.
Astral van, yeah.
And the GMC version of it.
Right, two of them. And then there was a Toyota which had been out for a while.
Yes.
That's kind of interesting.
It is an interesting. It's a very poor car, very poor vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
I read a Consumer's Report evaluation of the. At that time, the GM van was not out, but between the VW
Vanagon,
the Toyota, and the Chrysler ones, the Chrysler came out far ahead of the other two.
Yes.
The Toyota was by far the worst. It has a very short wheelbase and tends to go like this and very underpowered and
very short.
Yeah.
Underpowered too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the van again?
Underpowered and I forget what all was wrong with it. The Chrysler vans are rated much higher. I think when all the dust settles the Ford, if they ever make it. Do you know if they really plan to manufacture that?
Yeah, they've selected the plant. I think it's Atlanta, and I think they roll sometime this month.
Well, I guess they are going to make it. I remember that article where they said they took the roof panel contours right from the design center model.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad they're going to finally make it. I thought they were never going to.
They were
fiddling around.
Apparently, had some fire problems with robotics and so forth.
Yeah.
Well, here you are in the mid-70s.
Yeah, it will.
I'm sorry.
I'm not even in the mid-60s yet.
I'm sorry. Forgive me. I thought so.
Getting close to it, though.
Okay. Yeah. So here you are in the mid-60s.
70s. Oh, you mean age-wise now?
No, in chronologically.
Oh. Well, actually, I retired in at the end of 78.
Okay, so and you're in the early to mid 70s, and
yeah.
What is your situation like?
Well, my situation was I was becoming, I guess you might say, fed up.
Mm-hmm.
I was.
What contributed to this?
Well, I think I sensed, I could never prove it, that I was being bypassed for promotion because of age, the
uh-huh.
age element.
Yeah.
And
you call it being shelved?
Oh, I don't know. You can't actually prove it.
Yeah.
That was one thing. The increasing government regulations were beginning to make the work less and less interesting because you keep running into a obstruction almost everywhere you turn.
Yeah.
And I was beginning to feel that I was, as I was getting older, I was starting to use my life in a way that I didn't really like anymore. There wasn't any fun. I wasn't likely to get promoted anymore. There wasn't too much excitement left. And I got to thinking more and more about the fact that I was getting on into my 50s and beyond, and that I would rather have time to do with what I wanted to do with my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I sought an early retirement, and when I looked at the figures that it generated, they looked very good to me, very attractive. So I went ahead and did it, and have never regretted it.
What do you think contributed to this this atmosphere that you found in your own career?
Well, I just think it was an accumulation of things. The fact that I nothing more was happening to me. I always seemed to be in an area up till that time where I would, you know, get a transfer into a new assignment.
You're still overall interior?
Yes, director of the interior design office, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I had a pretty good sense that I was being bypassed for promotions by much younger guys,
uh-huh.
which didn't
what
feel...
What would have been a logical step for you at that point?
A logical step at that point would have been for me to be promoted to an executive director.
Mm-hmm.
But this didn't happen.
Uh-huh.
And I sensed that it was certainly because of age.
How old were you at that time?
Oh, 57 or so.
Not elderly, by any means.
No. But, you know, they were promoting people past me that were in their early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Just like this thing that happened at Chrysler recently, this chap, Tom Gale, is it?
Yes.
41 years old. Now, I imagine there are a number of pretty highly placed design personnel in Chrysler that are older than that.
Yeah.
Probably like 57 or so, or 55 when I was. But they didn't get promoted. And I think, I'm surmising now, it was probably because of age, for one thing. I'm sure the guy they promoted was certainly very competent, but
also very young.
Yes, young.
Yeah. You're speaking of the situation as of April 1985, where Don Della Rosa has shifted to the West Coast to design.
Yeah, I don't know. You could say he was put out to pasture. Well, that's not a bad pasture to be in.
No, not bad.
At age 62, probably got a raise out of it. And gets to live in California. I'm sure he. I'm sure he would want to be there.
Yeah.
He's got his. If his work is there. On the other hand, he had authority over that place anyway.
Yeah.
Plus the Detroit-based design center, so he's got less.
Yes. He's got a strong, two strong people above him too.
Yes.
In the persons of Sperlich and Michael.
Right.
Well, forgive me for sounding a bit pompous, but would you like to, at some length, to sum up your design philosophy, if there is such a thing?
Design philosophy,
over your long career?
I don't think I ever had one.
That's good.
If you look back on it, it's a matter of trying to do the best you can so that what you do gets noticed. Like any other business, You won't get ahead in it unless you do well and get noticed.
Mm-hmm.
People have to see you do things that are good and have to be impressed by your ability. And of course, as you go up in management, you have to acquire management skills of dealing with people in the right way so that you get the best out of them without being overbearing. And as far as I know, I've been told that I have guys that have worked for me told my wife that I was a great boss.
Mm-hmm.
I let them do their work instead of doing it for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with them and not in competition with them like some guys do. They liked working for me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's things like that that help you get up to the ladder.
Yeah.
And getting up the ladder is really what it's all about. And it doesn't really take a philosophy. I never had a Bauhaus approach, for instance, where I take one look of something or one characteristic and carry it through a whole series of product design. I don't think you could do that in the car business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you'd be obsolete before you were very far along the way. It's a matter of being conscious of contemporary competitive design. And other elements, sociologically and so forth, make up the time frame that you're designing for. That's, which is difficult because you're always designing for a time frame in the future. And sometimes you wind up with the right thing in the wrong time, like the Edsel and Mark II Continental, and there's a number of them done by other companies too. It's always difficult because you're in the business of forecasting the future to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
And you hopefully aren't going to be wrong. But I just adapted my design thinking as I went along, changing it, you know, with the times, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes being influenced by people higher in the organization than me, for better or worse, but as a rule, things worked out pretty good.
At Ford, who were some of your major, looking back, your major influences?
Well, the early influences were numerous because I was pretty new at the business. Some of the important ones that I recall were Bob McGuire, Della Rosa, Gil Spear, I see those in particular at the outset. After that, I don't think there were any really that influenced me that much. I guess I'd gotten my own feet on the ground and decided that I would do the influencing on my own.
Bob McGuire seems to have been universally respected
sort of
and liked.
He's sort of a father to all of us. A difficult person, strange person, unapproachable initially. You could be introduced to Bob, and it was like being introduced to a stone wall in a way. I mean, he was a very, very cool, distant type guy. But once you got to know him, you couldn't know him a nicer guy. Just great.
Very helpful too.
Yes, and a great musician too.
Oh yes, really.
Yeah, a flutist.
Wow.
Also played the sax. He introduced me to a lot of classical music.
Mm-hmm.
Had a great influence. Bach and Handel, flute and harpsichord sonatas,
yeah.
Stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he loved classical music. Could play a lot of it.
The early day of the LP or the late of the
yes,
period of the 78?
I still have the records, the Decca recordings that he influenced me to buy of the Bach and the Handel flute and harpsichord sonatas.
Mm-hmm.
Superb music. They still mm-hmm. sound great because you don't need stereophonic for two instruments. In fact, it probably sound better without it. Yeah.
Della Rosa has acquired a sort of an aura of some of his contemporaries were not too complimentary about him, but you seem to think that he had a
I wouldn't say exactly he's like Shinoda, but there may be some element there. He was a guy who was very much involved with loving life. He probably drank too much. He womanized a great deal. Marge is his third wife. I guess that part has settled down pretty much, and I think he stopped drinking entirely. He got really bad. Had to go into a drying out tank, time or another. Really hurt his career a lot, although he was greatly regarded by Iacocca, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even Iacocca, I guess, got kind of fed up with him showing up after lunch in a state of stupor, more or less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think all that is behind him.
Yes.
But even with this, with these personal problems, he's just a great designer,
mm-hmm.
a really great one.
Yeah. That's good to hear.
And I always liked him, and we got along fine, socialized with all three of his wives,
mm-hmm.
known
mm-hmm.
them all, been
mm-hmm.
out with them, you know, but
mm-hmm.
been to their homes and whatnot. And he's just a guy that I liked, and I never had any problems with him.
And he had a certain flair, and...
Oh, yeah. Well, he was fun to be with,
uh-huh.
up to a point. Then he got to be too much.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like Duncan McRae. Overly partying,
mm-hmm.
you want to call it that, or carousing or whatever. It's,
mm-hmm.
You know, they got carried away with it. You know, they disappear for days at a time. That kind of thing.
Interesting. Both of them are fairly highly regarded by discerning.
Duncan was... he committed suicide less than a year ago, which nobody can still believe because the guy was so in love with liveliness, I guess. He was not a great designer, he was a good one, and he was a good guy to have on your staff, reliable,
mm-hmm.
for the most part.
What about Bordenay? Can you give us a critique of Bordenay and his career? He seems to touched so many lives, so many of your contemporaries.
Yeah, well, again, he's another personal friend. Has been for many, many, many years. I first ran across him at Fisher Body at the Trim and Hardware
mm-hmm.
styling thing. He sat at the drawing table behind me,
mm-hmm.
and we just, you know, did our thing there.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot from him. He had previous design experience before the war at GM Styling,
mm-hmm.
and he knew how to render much better than I did, and I just learned a lot from him, design and rendering,
mm-hmm.
by just looking at what he was doing, and having him teach me certain tricks,
mm-hmm.
how to do this, how to do that.
Was he generous with this?
Oh yeah, right. Well, Gene has always been a bit of an egotist,
mm-hmm.
and I guess the position of finding himself able to teach somebody, to impart
yeah.
something that was good or something, kind of was flattering to him, you know. But he had some, well, there's not much difference in our ages, but some kid that was struggling, you know, they could help out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway.
You're pretty much contemporaries at Ford,
aren't you? Yeah.
Yeah.
At Ford? Well, not quite.
Right.
He decided that Truman Hardware was not his thing to do, and he wanted to get into real automotive styling.
Mm-hmm.
And he put together a portfolio, and he went to Ford and got hired immediately. And shortly after that, he called me, and he said, you know, you really ought to come over here. He said, he said, they'll hire you right away. He said, make up a portfolio and come over here. So I did. I got hired right away, of course. So he had been there a few months, and he and McGuire were in charge of advanced design, whatever that was at the time. Mm-hmm. We didn't really cross paths an awful lot for many years because he was always in a different part of the design operation and usually a couple of steps ahead of me up the management ladder.
A master politician, I think.
Very good, yeah. But with a great deal of ability to back it up.
Yes. Yeah.
But we just never, I never, until I became a chief stylist, I never worked for Gene directly.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That is interesting. Never worked for him directly. So he kept going up the ladder and working in different studios. He was the Mercury chief stylist when I was in the Ford studio, and Joe Orris was the chief stylist, and we just never crossed paths in a working relationship.
Well, on the whole, you've had a fascinating and interesting life as a...
Yes, yeah, I would say that I had a very interesting life, and I did what I really wanted to do with my life even before I kind of knew what I wanted to do. I never wanted to be a surgeon or an aeronautical engineer like my parents thought, and I knew I wanted to be a car designer even when I was in high school, but I had no idea at all how to go about doing it. But things fell into place. And I did, and it did, and I'm happy with it ever since.
Right.